Well, all right, let's talk a little movies here. Three of them to discuss, and well, a wide range of films
this
week.
I think that is a fair assessment. It was a really good movie weekend, all things considered. We've got the almost box office winner of the weekend, the new Baz Luhrmann biopic, Elvis. We've got the very good horror thriller, The Black Phone. Last but certainly not least, Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe.
Wow.
Where would you like to start, Rich?
Oh, my goodness.
I'm going to tell you right now, I loved all of these movies.
All right. Well, let's, because I want to see it, let's hear about The Black Phone.
Okay. So, for those who are unfamiliar, The Black Phone. Okay. So, sometimes when you hear about a movie, you see like the various pieces of how that movie came to be, and you're like, the people involved and all, and you start to get excited. Because when the pieces fit together right, the increase in quality is exponential rather than geometric. So when you have good source material, good filmmakers, good production team, like when all those things really sort of feed on each other, and you get something that that greatly exceeds even the sum of the very good parts. This was one of those movies for me because The Black Phone, it's based on the short story of the same name by Joe Hill. It's an excellent story. The filmmaker, Scott Derrickson, he directed and co-wrote the screenplay alongside C. Robert Cargill. And those two are legit like horror sort of enthusiasts. Derrickson's probably best known for, he directed the first Doctor Strange movie, but he's done a bunch of horror films, Sinister and Insidious, and just some really wonderful stuff. On the production side, films produced by Jason Blum and Blumhouse, and those guys know what's up when it comes to horror films. So you put all of these pieces together, and it's like, oh, okay, so this is bound to be good. And not only is it good, it's very good. It's a really almost a throwback kind of movie in a lot of ways, and we'll talk about that in a second. But so the basic gist is it's the year 1978. We're in the suburbs of Denver, and the community is sort of under a cloud because there is a serial child abductor on the loose. This person has taken a number of children. He's been colloquially sort of nicknamed the Grabber by the kids of the community, and so there's this sort of shadow cast over this small town, and so we meet Finney Shaw, a young man played by a very good young actor named Mason Thames. And his sister Gwen, played by Madeline McGraw. They live in this town. They're with their single father, who's an alcoholic and a bit of an abuser. He's played by Jeremy Davies, who's unfortunately very good at playing this sort of character, but that's neither here nor there. Finney and Gwen have a great relationship. They love each other. They support each other. But we've got Finney. He's a smart, he's sensitive, and so he's kind of a target for bullies. He struggles to stand up for himself, although his best friend Robin, played by Miguel Mora, is the toughest kid in school. So he's got a little bit of, like, he's got someone who's got his back, which is nice. Things start to get complicated when people that Finney knows start disappearing. There's a baseball rival who gets taken, and when that happens, we start to get a little more insight into maybe the spookier side of things, because as it turns out, Gwen had a dream about Bruce being abducted and told Bruce's sister before it happened. And so that's all well and good, but the cops show up at the school to question her because the dream had within it details that had not been released to the public.
Ooh,
and so everyone's like, so they want to know how she knew. And this is when we learn apparently she sometimes has these strange dreams that are true. we find out that this has been an ongoing thing when she is severely punished by her father for sharing this information, because the kid's mother, who's no longer with us, also had these sorts of dreams, and they led in some rather dark directions. And it's implied, it's never explicitly stated, but it's implied that they contributed to her death. We lose a few more kids, and then it's Finney's turn, and he winds up in a basement cell, just a mattress on the floor, and a black rotary phone on the wall that disconnected, not connected to anything. This is when he meets the Grabber, played by Ethan Hawke, who is awesome in this movie. Not least because he wears a mask the entire time.
Wow.
So full face, like it's like eye holes, like that's all you get. And so you have this sort of, he's got this strange affect to his voice, and we're never really clear what his motivations are. Like, why is this happening? We don't know. And so the kid is sitting there, and you know, he freaks out for a little bit and then just sort of resigns himself. He's like, well, this is it. I'm going to die. And then the phone rings. And he picks it up, and there are voices on the other end, voices that don't seem to know where they are or who they are. But they start telling him things that perhaps, if everything goes right, might help him survive this ordeal.
Mm.
And then it plays out. And that's where we'll stop there. I won't spoil anything there. But yes, it is a wonderfully spooky device that is, I'll just say, wonderfully executed. Now, this movie feels very much like a throwback. There's the period setting, of course, and it has a very sort of late 70s aesthetic to it in a lot of ways. But it's reminiscent of the sorts of horror movies that you would see in the late 1970s. Like it is evocative of its era. Both in terms of its setting and the type of movie that it is, while still having a very modern sensibility. Like this is a movie that would have been perfectly at home as the second movie at a drive-in double feature. Do you know what I mean?
It's got
that kind of, but it's very elevated. Like the like stylistically, it's really fascinating. A lot of wonderful directorial choices, and it's spooky as hell, man. You always worry about these sorts of supernaturally tinged horror films because lazy filmmakers have a tendency to use those elements as a crutch. Like it's, you know, it doesn't have to make sense because ghosts or whatever. And they don't do that here. Like it is woven into the story for sure. But the filmmakers, and they do such a great job of this, they never lose sight of just like, even if there aren't any sort of supernatural elements, like kid trapped in a basement by a crazy person, that's scary. And they really lean into those fears. And so we have this wonderful sort of combination of factors coming together to create a movie that is really like deeply unsettling in a lot of ways. But also like it's surprisingly funny in spots. Like you wouldn't expect a movie revolving around child abduction to have a lot of moments of levity. But yeah, there are some legitimately laugh out loud moments in this movie and it's wonderful because it sort of punctures the tension, but it also helps to elevate it a little bit.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's such a fine line to walk, but they do such a wonderful job of walking it. The performances are great. The kids are phenomenal. Mason Thames, I'd never seen this kid before. But he's legitimately talented. Like he's really, really good. Young Madeline McGraw, who plays the sister, she's also awesome. And I have to make a specific note of this. I love it when a kid curses in a movie.
Well, yeah. Or in real life.
One of the better young cursers on screen that I've seen in a long time. You know, this is the sort of thing that matters to me. And of course, Ethan Hawke, who is just like, he goes for it in such a wonderful way. And it's great because like, he clearly has a relationship with Scott Derrickson and Jason Blum. Like, he's done a number of these movies before. He was in Sinister. The Purge was a Blumhouse movie. Like, he has that connection with them, and so is comfortable enough to push it a little bit. And push it in ways that you might not necessarily expect. This is not a ranting, raving kind of performance. And I think that makes it scarier.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's just, like, there's something very, like, restrained, but, mm-hmm. like, but that sort of struggle to restrain that's always sort of lingering beneath the surface. And the incredible part is he's doing all this with, you know, a mask covering it's just his eyes and his voice. Like, that's really all he's able to do. The Black Phone... I expected to like it. I wasn't sure I was going to like it as much as I did.
Talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge here on Pass the Popcorn. All right, Baz Luhrmann, always subtle in his films, taking on the king of rock and roll and giving us Tom Hanks in a fat suit. How's it all work?
Oh, man, it makes sense, doesn't it? Like,
it does.
Like, if you're going to do an Elvis biopic, like, you know, someone larger than life, you gotta have someone who does larger than life. And I don't know that there are many out there who do that better than Baz Luhrmann. It's funny, because if you're familiar with Luhrmann's work, you pretty much know what this movie looks like. Big, splashy, we get, you know, we venture into, you know, these sort of vivid, over-the-top, kind of surreal moments blending together with, you know, more feints towards actual realism. It's really good. There's one glaring problem with it, and I hate to say it. It hurts my feelings to say it.
I know what you're going to say.
It's Tom Hanks. And it's not the fault of Tom Hanks the actor. I need to stress that. But he doesn't work. He doesn't work here. And the character as created doesn't work here.
Because I haven't seen it yet, but from what I've read, but he uses Colonel Tom Parker as essentially the narrator of the story. Right?
Like, that's the framing device. Basically, the movie starts in 1997 with Colonel Parker dying in a hospital bed. And it's him basically speaking to us, the audience, directly and saying, you've heard all this stuff about my relationship with Elvis. That's not how it went at all. And then we have the big, bold, like outlandish sort of dream sequence with, you know, with Colonel Tom getting out of bed and like wandering through an empty casino and like just like the weird camera angles and bright colors and everything sort of spinning and skewed. And it's great. Like, I love Baz Luhrmann's work. So like, this is, I'm here for it. And then we sort of settle into the actual story, which is, you know, I'm not going to go through it. I mean, it's really a cradle to grave story, of Elvis. Like, we meet him first when he's a young man, sort of first discovering his love of music and the strange sort of juxtaposition of his adoration for rhythm and blues and his affection for gospel music. Like, we get a wildly overwrought scene bringing those two things together. Again, this Baz Luhrmann is not for everyone. Your mileage may vary. I gotta be upfront with that. I love what he does.
Did I hear he even drops in a little animated sequence?
It's all of it, man. Like, all of it is here. So we meet Elvis as a young man, and then we spend a little time with Colonel Tom at some carnival. He's a carny, essentially, promoting a country singer by the name of Hank Snow.
Hank Snow, yes.
And Hank Snow's, dim-witted younger brother. But he hears, That's All Right Mama on the radio. The Sun Records release from Sam Phillips. And he's like, they have a whole conversation about it, and then it sort of clicks, and Colonel Tom is like, that's my guy. That is, I'm going to be part of that. And meets up with him. They have a weird convoluted conversation on a Ferris wheel, and then Elvis agrees to be represented by Colonel Tom, and then we're off, and we go through all aspects of his life, from his time his early touring days up through his time with Ed Sullivan, And then, you know, the explosion of popularity and his contribution to the downfall of the youth of America, followed by his time in Germany and in the armed forces, his return, his starting at the top and rapid descent in Hollywood, followed by there's actually an extended section of the movie devoted to the 68 comeback special, which is great. Mm. It's among the better parts of the movie. It's so on the nose, Rich. He's just, you know, hanging out at the old Hollywood sign, thinking about stuff. The dudes come up and they're like, we want to produce your comeback. We want to produce the holiday special. And they're like, and he's like, oh, what is your, and this is, apparently this is a real thing. He's like, what do you think of my career? And it's like, your career's in the toilet.
We had Steve Binder on who produced the special. And that's absolutely verbatim that Elvis said, yeah, what do you think? And he said, what career?
Yeah.
It's in the toilet. You got nothing.
Yep. And so we get that. And then on to Vegas Elvis and so on and so forth. And in the middle of it all is Colonel Tom pulling the strings or trying to pull the strings. Mm. And it's we get to see the sort of toxicity of that relationship, the back and forth, the dynamic between Elvis and Tom versus the dynamic he shared with with his mother and for much longer his father, Vernon. And we spend a little time at Graceland, we meet Priscilla, you know, all this stuff, and it's pretty linear. Like, it's more linear than Lerman tends to be as a rule. And then we all know how tragically tragically young Elvis passed away, and we get a sort of coda courtesy of Colonel Tom, and that's the movie. It's really in so many ways a delightful movie. Bright colors, so outsized, larger than life. And that's who Elvis was, you know what I mean? And so it's this wonderful match of director and subject, which is great. I got to talk about Austin Butler, who's great. He's like legitimately great in this part. Like he looks wonderful. He's better as the young Elvis than as the older Elvis, but that's just, he's a young man, so right, it's right.
And in the early Elvis, he's doing the singing.
He is. Yeah. He does all the early Elvis singing, and for the later Elvis, apparently they did something where he sang, but they blended the vocals with the actual Elvis vocals to sort of kind of lend a sort of consistency to it all. Which it's a wonderful idea. I've never heard of anyone doing anything like that. Mm. It sounds wildly complicated and horribly expensive, but it's Baz Luhrmann. What does he care? But the supporting players, nobody gets a lot of play beyond Elvis and Colonel Tom. So, but supporting performances are all pretty strong. And now we get to the elephant in the room. I love Tom Hanks. This character feels like he's in a completely different movie than everybody else. He's buried under prosthetics and a fat suit. He's adopted some sort of air quotes European accent. Like, I don't really know where he's supposed to be from.
Dutch.
Yeah.
It's a Dutch accent.
Yeah, but
apparently he doesn't.
But it's not really. Yeah. I mean, I guess ish, but it just, it's so funny because, you've got all these layers of artifice and it's still, at the center, it's still Tom Hanks. And you can't not see Tom Hanks. Yeah. And in a lot of circumstances, that would be okay. But when you're talking about someone who so clearly intended to be the villain of the story, even if we are sort of viewing a lot of it through his sort of skewed perspective, if you can't not see Tom Hanks, it's really hard to be mad at Tom Hanks. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
And so you sort of, you lose a little bit of that conflict, and that conflict is intended to be the center of the movie. And so when that's weakened at all, you just lose a little bit of it. And so, yeah, it sounds weird because he's such a major part of the film, but other than that, everything is great. The music is phenomenal. I'm an Elvis fan. I'm more of a late Elvis fan than an early Elvis fan, which, by the way, the scene where they're establishing his first go round at the International, like when they're putting the show together, like they do a sort of sequence where he's like sort of leading the band in these sort of, like, just that, for that alone, it's worth the price of admission. It's such a great scene. And it's a wonderful sort of indicator of, it really represents the sort of hold that Elvis was able to have on people and the way he could sort of inspire creative energies from the people around him when he was right. And then, you know, we sort of see the sort of tragic sort of, you know, the other side of that a little bit. Again, like I said, Butler does a great job. It's a wonderful film to look at. The music is phenomenal. And yeah, I mean, if you can get past the ridiculousness that is Tom Hanks as Colonel Tom, like, it's a really good movie.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Alan. Finally, Beavis and Butthead are back.
Did you know that was happening?
No, I did not.
I feel like a lot of people
didn't know it until I saw your tweet earlier today. Like, what?
Well, it's funny. I didn't know it was happening until about a week ago. And I pay attention to this stuff for a living.
Right.
You know, and so it was this wonderful sort of this little gift from up on high. It was just it's like, wait, there's really going to be another Beavis and Butthead movie? And so, full disclosure, I, as someone who is in my mid-40s, I was a teenage boy in high school when Beavis and Butthead were in their heyday. And so I am 100% the target audience for this film.
Right.
And I'm not ashamed of that. I loved the show. I loved it. I loved, you know, and I, you know, the more satirical elements of it maybe went over my head a little bit when I was a kid. But yeah, loved the show. And the idea that they could bring these characters back and in a movie set in the present day, like, it didn't make sense to me. I'm like, how do you do this? Like, these dudes as they were in the mid 90s simply don't exist anymore, because you know, instead of sitting on the, you know, instead of, you know, lighting fires in the backyard and watching, you know, heavy metal videos, they're on 4chan.
Yeah.
You know, they're internet edgelords, you know, shouting racial slurs into the void. So it's like, so how do you do this? And it's stupid as hell, but it's an ingenious idea. So here's how it plays out. We start in 1998. The fellas are they're at the science fair at the high school. You know, everyone's doing their projects, and Butthead is repeatedly kicking Beavis in the groin, which is, it's like that we're hitting the ground running,
right? There you go.
Which is fantastic. Through circumstances completely within their control, they wind up burning the gym down, and they get sent before a judge. And the judge, rather than throwing the book at them, decides it's not their fault; it's society's fault. And so, instead of punishing them, the judge gives them the grand prize from the science fair, which was a trip to space camp. So they go to space camp, and that's where they meet an astronaut by the name of Selena, voiced by Andrea Young, and she's the mission commander for the space shuttle mission. And, you know, they're farting around with stuff they're not supposed to be touching. And then it turns out that their single-mindedness with regard to, you know, sex stuff makes them uniquely suited to run this one machine that's going to put a telescope into orbit so they can look at what they believe to be a black hole out in space. And so, as you do, she was like, hey, NASA, let's put these guys on the space shuttle mission. And NASA's like, all right. She goes up to them and is like, hey, you know that stuff you were doing? Like, how would you like to do that for real? Which, you know, any normal human would be like, oh, yeah, you want me to do this machine stuff only in, you know, for real. What they think is, we're going to score. they wind up on the space shuttle and wouldn't you know, disaster strikes.
Hmm.
And they wind up jettisoned into the void. hurtling into space, and they wind up getting sucked into the black hole.
Oh.
And then, well, it's 2022.
Ah.
And they're dropped onto the beach in Galveston, Texas, unchanged, unharmed. They climb out of the water onto the beach. First thing they see is a big old billboard. Former mission commander Selena is now the governor of Texas, and she's running for re-election. And, well, you know what? These boys have a score to settle. Wink, wink. And so they're off, and they're wandering around trying to, trying to score. And they're also being tracked by the FBI, who saw the anomaly open up, and they're like, oh my God, it's an alien invasion. The Pentagon is involved. The governor is like, people are going to find out what I did. And so she's like, we have to have them killed. And so everybody's trying to find Beavis and Butthead. Meanwhile, they've come into possession of a smartphone whose workings they 100% do not understand. They're using it. They're basically using it to buy nachos until they accidentally activate Siri, who they mistake for Serena, and they decide that, you know, Beavis develops a relationship with Siri. You know, she's a good listener, and they start sort of crisscrossing Texas, having various hijinks in their quest to, again, and I can't stress this enough, score. Meanwhile, they're being occasionally guided by their multiversal counterparts, Smart Beavis and Smart Butthead, who appear out of nowhere to tell them that they have to go find this portal or else the multiverse will collapse.
Wow.
It's all very complicated and all very, very stupid, and I loved it so very, very much. It's Mike Judge doing the heavy lifting, like he does all the voices and all that stuff. But it really is remarkable what a wonderful collection of past and present, like, Judge fans who are involved. Folks who have worked on previous projects with him, like Stephen Root's in this, Nat Faxon, Gary Cole, Tig Notaro, Martin Starr, and they're all clearly having a blast doing this. The animation's a little different. They switched to Dino Stanimopoulos's Titmouse animation studio. They do Archer, and you can tell, like, everyone aside from Beavis and Butthead has a little bit of off-brand Archer look to them, as opposed to the form of the original animation. But man, I laughed so much. It was one of those things where, like, I'm laughing and I'm like, this is so GD stupid, and I'm having such a wonderful time. Like, it really felt like I'd been transported back in time.
He's 17,
like,
again.
You know what I mean? And it was just, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I just want to go and kick one of my buddies in the balls and call him a fart knocker, and laugh under my breath and make fun of a heavy metal music video. It was such a wonderful sort of, like, nostalgia trip, but one that it didn't feel as toxic as nostalgia often does. Mm. Like, it just really had this wonderful, just sort of, and it sounds ridiculous to say, this very pure, like, look back at who I was during my teenage years.
Simpler times.
You know, and I can't stress this enough. I am square in the wheelhouse of this movie. I'm in my mid-40s. If you are even a couple of years older than me or a couple of years younger than me, this movie is probably not for you, because it is so very specifically of a place and time. And, but for those of us who were there in the moment, look, all I can say is, man, this movie rules.
Thank you, Alan.
My pleasure.
Alan Adams talking movies with us here on Pass the Popcorn.